Hi, everyone. Welcome to an Alan Smithy podcast. My name is Matt. I write at cinemachine.blogspot.com.
And I'm Andrew, and I write at thestopbutton.com.
And this is our podcast where we talk about one good movie and one bad movie for about 1 hour. We also do commentary tracks, and we might be switching over to that format entirely by about our 100th episode. But we got a little ways to go, so this week we thought we would do a double feature of the 1942 much underappreciated, as it turns out, comedy film I Married a Witch, starring Veronica Lake. And then, through a couple of tangents, we end up at Bewitched from 2005 by the despicable Nora Ephron. And, well, the lineage between the two is that even though I Married a Witch came out about 25 years before the Bewitched TV show, it's you can definitely see the inspiration was there. And yeah, well, we're going to start with that one. Like I say, I think it's extremely underrated. It's funny. It's one of those titles, and maybe I only even knew the title because someone else mentioned it in reference to Bewitched, but I think a lot of people have heard the title I Married a Witch, even if they haven't seen the film. I don't think most people have. This is a really great screwball 40s comedy, like with everything that you'd want from it, like really funny character actors, a witty script, really quick pacing, a really, you know, beautiful girl as one of the stars. It didn't surprise me to find out reading the IMDb trivia after seeing it that Preston Sturges started out as producer on this, and instead of Friedrich March as the guy who, you know, ends up marrying the witch, Veronica Lake, Sturges wanted to use Joel McRae, who co-starred with Veronica Lake in Sullivan's Travels, and then I guess maybe Joel McRae didn't want to, you know, get typecast or something. But that's probably like the only thing that could have made this movie better, really, because it's really, really superb in all aspects. And, you know, Joel McRae and Veronica Lake obviously had really great chemistry in Sullivan's Travels. And, you know, they could have been like the Nick and Nora of the 40s, you know, except they wouldn't be playing the same characters over and over again. But they had such great chemistry in Sullivan's Travels. It's like, why didn't – yeah.
Well, I think I had a I thought he didn't want to do it because he hated her.
And well, mate – yeah.
Yeah, and that's like the funniest thing about it is that Friedrich March apparently – hated her too, and they're wonderful together. And well, it makes no sense. It's like did every one of her co-stars except Alan Ladd hate her, and they're he didn't want to work with her again. They just did not like each other, and I mean Lake humiliated March throughout the shoot and stuff. I mean it was just like, but you watch the movie and it's just wonderful. And they're wonderful together. And it's just – so, I mean, on one hand, you have professionalism, but you also just have, you know, people who, regardless, are able to create chemistry.
Tells you something about the professionalism in the golden age of Hollywood there. Yeah. So, right. But, you know, in some aspects, it really could feel like a Preston Sturges movie. I mean, not just because it's got a light touch and and it moves quickly, and it's got Veronica Lake, but it's also got a couple of Preston Sturges repertory actors. You got Robert Warwick, and also Robert Benchley, who's always my favorite Preston Sturges character actor. They just play, you know, supporting parts and stuff. You know, actually, speaking of, the light touch and Preston Sturges, I mean, you think about Preston Sturges movies, and it's not just all silliness, you know. Like, Preston Sturges movies actually kind of dip in and out of dramatic weight. I mean, always, you know, to their benefit and not incongruously. There's really serious moments in Sullivan's Travels. There's really serious moments in a lot of his movies. And oddly enough, I Married a Witch kind of has a couple of serious moments that are almost like out of a horror movie that almost gave me like a Night of the Demon vibe, even though that's like 10 years later. But the movie kind of acknowledges the Satanism of witches, because Veronica Lake's dad is also a witch, and there's a couple of scenes where he shows up and he's like basically he basically like threatens Friedrich March's life. And I mean, there's one scene in particular. It's really creepy where he manifests himself in human form because he and Veronica Lake kind of go in and out of human form throughout the movie. But he manifests himself and he basically like frames Friedrich March for murder. And like, and as he's dying, he's telling Friedrich March how he's going to, you know, be put in the electric chair, and it's not being played for laughs. It's really creepy. But then somebody runs in the room right after he's done dying and there's like a funny moment and you're kind of like, oh, that's right, this is a comedy, even though that was a really kind of eerie moment. So, you know, that's definitely the Preston Sturges influence there. But yeah, he's not credited as a producer. Again, IMDb trivia says, I guess he had differences with the director and co-screenwriter, René Clair, who's a Frenchman, and, directed some other movies of this era, but none that I have heard of before. I don't know about you.
No, I mean, that's kind of one of the things, is the name is memorable, but I think
he directed like some silence in the 20s and then sporadically in the 30s and sporadically in the 40s. This is only like one of four movies that he did throughout the entire decade of the 40s. So he kind of had his heyday before this. But the silent, you know, film background really comes through in all these like very simple, kind of corny but effective trick photography and just, you know, props on wires kind of effects that they have when Veronica Lake and her dad are sort of floating around. First, they're floating around as smoke, so there's like reversed footage and just, you know, off-screen fans blowing the smoke around. but you know, he does smart, simple stuff, like, you know, there's this, like, at one point they're both hiding out in bottles on a table.
Yeah.
So as they're talking, the camera pans back and forth between the two bottles, and you hear Veronica Lake and her dad talking. I'm trying to look up the name of the actress so I don't have to keep saying her dad. But, you know, it's like, yeah, René Clair's direction is great because, you know, it does all that simple stuff. And jumping ahead to Bewitched for just a second, I mean, Bewitched was full of, you know, corny, you know, physical gags, and that's probably, you know, they probably saw the producers remembered this movie and they were like, oh, they did a lot of simple, you know, comedic stuff just with props. Why don't we do that?
Yeah, I mean, the movie's got a weird sort of... It opens in, I guess following either the Salem witch trials or something, much like the Salem witch trials. And then you get this long sequence of Friedrich March playing his descendants, and he's been cursed to be unlucky in love.
That was another kind of very Preston-esque, yeah, kind of opening.
But yeah, it's all very dark and unhappy.
Yeah,
and then
it's almost got this odd, like, British or even just European kind of morbid humor about ghosts and curses. It's almost like, you know, Dead of Night, the British horror,
yeah,
anthology film.
And then you get to the modern day, and he is about to become governor, and he's also about to marry Susan Hayward, and it's during Susan Hayward's evil sort of bitch roles period, where she wasn't the leading lady, but she was the bitchy other lady. And so he's just miserably unhappy and so on and so forth. And when Veronica Lake's witch does get sort of freed from the situation his ancestor cursed her to, well, it's like, the ancestor imprisoned her, so she cursed him. You know, for, I think the movie's only, what, about 80 minutes long. I'd say for the first 35 minutes, she's out to, like, make his life even worse. So it's kind,
yeah,
of like, it's really disturbing because it's like, she's already cursed him. She's already successful, so she decides she's just going to make his life a little bit worse.
That's the funny thing, is like how antagonistic Veronica Lake's character is. Yeah, like you say, she's out to make his life worse. I mean, you know, in mischievous ways, but still, I mean, we're talking because we've established all this backstory about how she and her dad are hundreds of years old, and they can and you know they're evil. I mean, you know, cartoonishly evil, but evil nonetheless. Yeah, you're kind of like, where's this going? And the point at which you know see how the love triangle between Friedrich March and Veronica Lake and Susan Hayward is going to start up is because Veronica Lake says, you know, oh, I'm going to make his life miserable by making him fall in love with me, and then he won't be able to have me. And so she, you know, conjures up a love potion, and then the twist in the story happens, and this is like, you know, almost at the halfway point practically, she accidentally drinks the love potion, and now she's in love with him. And that's how they're going to end up together. Like, you realize that as soon as they're at that point. And they kind of explain, you know, they kind of have Friedrich – they're not really sure. It's almost like the writers weren't really sure how to have Friedrich March fall in love with her at that point, because at that point she's just this crazy woman who appeared out of nowhere and is like – you know, he's running for governor, and he's got like this, you know, cute girl showing up everywhere he goes, and he's a, you know, engaged man, and he's going to ruin her career and everything. They can't figure out how to have him fall in love with her, so they literally just do it as a joke. They have him like start to give this speech about how she's just infatuated with him and it's just a girlish crush, and you know, she needs to understand what real love is. And then you pan to the clock on the wall and the hands spin around, and then you pan back to him and he's in love with her because he spent all night explaining what love is to her, and that like did the trick, I guess.
Yeah, that feels like a very Sturgis moment too.
Yeah, it makes me wonder what that scenario was in the book, because this was based on a novel.
Yeah, and the story behind that is of course very interesting too. It's based on an unfinished novel that someone else finished, and then they adapted into a movie. And
yeah, I noticed how odd that was in the opening titles. It was like well, pretty much what you were saying, but it's something that's like you don't see those kinds of credits anymore, or hardly ever.
I mean, the idea that not a lot of books go.
Oh, here it is. Screenplay by Robert Pirosh and Mark Connolly, based upon a story by Thorne Smith, completed by Norman Mattson. So those are four completely different people who had their hands in this. And then you add on top of that that you've got Preston Sturges and the director.
And I believe someone else, right?
And again, according to IMDb, Dalton Trumbo did some kind of ghost.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very...
Got a
busy
lot of hands
script.
In this spot.
And
yeah.
What I find curious about it is that most of, I mean, it is unknown. I think I saw it for the first time. I cannot remember if it was on AMC back when AMC was good.
AMC used to play black and white movies.
AMC used to be. Imagine how great Turner Classic Movies is, but AMC was that plus Fox and Paramount and Universal. AMC used to be amazing, and then they went to crap, and it like it's gotten to be so long since they were any good. I mean, they were good, say, 1998, 97, yeah. 98. And then they went to crap when they moved down the dial, so to speak, of the cable stations. But I can never remember. Well, some of the problem with I Married a Witch is that it has a very interesting, it was produced by Paramount. They decided they didn't want it because they had enough, and so they sold it to UA, and UA released it. And then Wikipedia has that it was released on video in the U.S. in 1990. I might have seen it on video, too, because when I went to college, the video store was just amazing. But so the backstory of all that, of course, gets you into this really interesting, you know, this is still the era when the studios owned the... theaters,
right?
And so it reminded me that there's a book called The Phantom Empire all about this, and I really need to read it because
It's a new one on me. I'll make a note of that.
Yeah, so it's one of those things that I don't think that people really understand is that, you know, it's the studios were making product, you know, they had the whole production chain. And this is one that sort of got lost. And so it's come out on DVD in, I believe, Spain.
Yeah, it's only available on, like, you know, low quality region zero
releases. Yeah,
it hasn't gotten its due because people don't even know about it. I mean, I think even Preston Sturges fans might kind of, you know, overlook this one. But what's funny is probably the only way that I've really heard this referenced is in relation to Veronica Lake. Like, it's one of her flagship roles, even if she is not known for that many movies, this is one of the movies that she is known for, even if not that many people have seen it. Because actually, like, you look at the poster, and it's pretty much like the same caricature of her that's on the poster for Sullivan's Travels, with her trademark hair over one side of the face, except she's got a little witch's cap on. And that's pretty much the poster. But yeah, I mean, this is a year after Sullivan's. It's like right at the peak of her popularity. Actually, hey, isn't this the same year that This Gun for Hire came out? Or if not, it's within like a couple of years of it. So yeah, no, this is her at her peak. And she is so cute in this. I guess you kind of forgive how evil she is because of how cute she is. And then when she drinks her love potion by accident, you can kind of be on her side finally, because then at that point her dad is really the antagonist. Oh, and the actor who plays her dad is Cecil Kellaway, by the way. And he's great. And I remembered the other horror moment, the other horror movie moment in this, which is that she's trying to get away from her dad and she's dragging Friedrich March away, and they jump into a cab, and then they realize the cabbie is her dad. And that's, you know, been copied in like a zillion horror movies and Twilight Zone episodes and whatnot since then. But you know, this movie probably wasn't too remarkable at its time. I mean, because there kind of was a fad for like ghost comedies and stuff, like with Topper and stuff like that.
Yeah.
The Ghost and Mrs. Muir. There were movies like this. I don't think there were movies like this that had witches in them, because, I mean, again, jumping ahead to Bewitched, I believe I've read somewhere that, like, you know, they were afraid that Bewitched was going to get letters from the South when it came on the air, because there were, you know, people who thought it would be promoting Satanism. I mean, that's not too far a stretch to believe. So, you know, you got to imagine when I Married a Witch came out, it didn't, you know, they didn't book it in Peoria, so to speak, but, you know, probably just brought it out on the coasts. In any case, it's got more bite to it than I thought it was going to have. And that was kind of a pleasant surprise, because that really kind of, I mean, there's urgency in the plot because it's a very farcical plot. I mean, by the end of the movie, you are in, you know, you do feel like you're watching a play or something, because, like, Veronica Lake is upstairs and the guy is supposed to get married to Susan Hayward downstairs. So he's running upstairs and downstairs back and forth, you know. But, you know, aside from the immediacy that the farcical, like, comedy plot brings, you've also got the immediacy that these are servants of Satan. And while Veronica Lake has fallen for Friedrich March and isn't going to do anything too awful to him, her dad is still a knight in Satan's service and does want to do something awful. And they only really dispose of him at the end by trapping him in a bottle, which is a very kind of sitcom-esque solution to the whole problem.
Of course, the end does jump ahead to show them happily married with children, who are starting to show their innate talents. And for some reason, that ending just sticks out to me because
I don't know if
it just seems a little
expected, perhaps.
Expected, but also, you know, I have a problem with the jump ahead ending in general because it suggests that they've become mundane. Their lives have become mundane. And yeah. So I think it's just my problem that it closes off their story. I mean, it kills the possibility of a sequel, right? Because, well...
Although not always.
Not always, but, you know, it just... she's barely recognizable.
It's your kids, Veronica. Something's got to be done about your
exactly.
kids.
Exactly. So, but other than that, I mean, and they do recover because there's the very the drunken warlock is a very funny situation in it. The movie's so short, so I guess you'd say for about 15 minutes, the drunken warlock cannot remember how to cast spells, which has, you know, stuck him as a mortal. So he can't deal with Frederick March, and so, yeah, I mean, it's just a really strange script, and it just all comes together, and hearing that it had problems is just it's one of those things where sometimes when problems create the best result.
It really is. I mean, because it wasn't, I mean, according to IMDb again, because look, there's not a lot of other places to get information on I Married a Witch. Apparently it wasn't just Friedrich March. Apparently everybody had problems with Veronica Lake. Like, nobody liked working with her. And, hey, maybe she was a bitch. I mean, maybe that's why her career was relatively short-lived in measurement to her popularity. On the other hand, maybe she was never that popular. I don't know. But she was popular enough that, whatever, Curtis Hanson decided to have Kim Basinger do an homage to her and assume that everybody would know who she was in stupid L.A. Confidential.
Ugh.
But in any case... yeah. Oh, actually, This Gun for Hire did come out the same year as this. Wow. This was really a great time for Veronica Lake. anyways, yeah, no, it's I couldn't recommend this highly enough. And, you know, however you got to get it, lie, cheat, steal, I mean, do what you need to do because it's, you know, the Blu-ray is probably a long friggin' way away at
and
this
it's,
point.
What's sad about the lack of releases is, you know, we've gotten to the point when Amazon and Apple are releasing stuff on their websites that you can't get anywhere else. And still, this has got no appreciation and no acknowledgement.
I know, which kind of baffles me because, like I said at the beginning, I think it is like a well-known... bizarrely, it's a well-known title without being...
It's a very well-known title.
That people have actually seen.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very well-known title. It's very peculiar that...
I guess it's just been parodied a lot over the years. I mean, because, like, what, 10 years later they had I Married a Communist, right?
I don't even think 10 years later. Well, but I don't necessarily think that... I don't think it was the first one to do I Married, was it?
I don't know.
I think that sort of... I think it was sort of in a zone with... It was in a genre with that. I don't know what the first I Married A was. The best way to find that is probably Leonard Maltin. Let me take a look. But yeah, it's just... The other thing is I think that Veronica Lake has never gotten, and I think this is due to Universal being in charge of her Paramount movies. She's never really gotten any DVD acknowledgement either.
Oh, no. How great would a Veronica Lake collection with this and This Gun for Hire and something else
well,
be?
Well, I mean, the Blue Dahlia is Universal. I think all of her...
Jane Mansfield got a Jane Mansfield collection 3-pack. I
mean, right.
Can't do this for Veronica.
All right, let's see. I Married a what? Yeah, I think that Veronica Mars is... Veronica Lake. Veronica Lake's fame in the movie I mean, what would you call it? Well, now we can say that amongst classic movie websites, she is nowhere near as popular as she was, say, 10 years ago, before popular movie websites could dictate what was getting released on DVD, or at least influence it. I Married a Strange Person is new. I Married an Angel. I Married an Angel, 1942.
Oh, what?
Yeah. So there are not
marriages to mythical figures.
Yeah, two, and then I Married a Communist was 10 years later, or 8 years later. It was 1950. I'm totally wrong. There are not a lot of I Marrieds.
I forgot about I Married a Strange Person. That's a Bill Plimpton animated film.
So yeah, it's just a
first, I believe. Yeah. The forgotten cult of Veronica, who of course provided the namesake for Veronica Lodge, around this time, or shortly thereafter.
And of course, Veronica Lake ended up a waitress.
Oh my God, that's
famous
awful
story. She ended up a waitress in somebody like came across her in the 60s and was like, "You're still alive." And she's like, "Yeah."
God, how awful. She should have let Mr. Smearcase keep his hand on her leg.
So yeah, it's just her career sort of, and I think that, well, I mean, Alan Ladd too, I think that. And I wonder, because Alan Ladd always was a popular classic movie star when I was starting to watch older movies, and he's really not anymore, and I wonder if it has something to do with the fact that most of his movies are from Paramount too, and so they're not going to be, you know.
Yeah, Paramount doesn't do a good job releasing any of their movies from any era.
No. Well, I mean, and the problem is that they're the Paramounts that got sold to Universal, so.
Yeah, so that catalog's getting the short shrift.
Yeah, it's a problem.
Yeah. And one last thing I'll say about Veronica Lake in this movie. I mean, it's like they sort of, you know, they sort of were really trying to build her up as an, I mean, this is such like a star-making role. It's almost about 20 minutes into the movie before you even see her face. You hear her voice because she's gas or smoke and, you know, flying around the city with her father. But until she assumes a human body, it's almost 20 minutes in. They really built her up a lot for a movie that's like less than an hour and 20 minutes. Anyways, great movie. Excellent movie. Track it down. See it. If you like Preston Sturges, you'll love this.
Yeah.
Preston Sturges could have directed this and you would believe it. It could have been his name on the movie and you're like, "Oh yeah. Yeah, this is classic Sturges right here." All right. Well, so jump forward a few years.
Okay.
We'll jump forward a few years and we've got Bewitched, and you know, I'm sure, and like Bewitched came on the air about 15 years after this movie, or 20 years, I guess. So, 25. I'm sure people still remembered I Married a Witch by the time Bewitched came on TV.
Well, Bewitched was – where is Bell, Book, and Candle in this whole because that's like the next witch movie that I can remember. Bell, Book, and Candle's 58.
1958, yeah.
So I think that Bell, Book, and Candle – maybe it's like a – I haven't seen it in many years. But it does not have the family aspect, the family trouble aspect as much as I Married a Witch does and has how Bewitched, of course, would.
Right. So wait, are you saying Bell, Book, and Candle is more or less of a family picture, let's call it?
Less of a family picture. I think that it gets some credit for Bewitched.
So is it a little more risque, let's say?
Yes. Well, it's Kim Novak, so yeah.
Okay. Well, and we're talking, you know, 58, so.
Yeah.
But okay, that doesn't – at the same time, that doesn't surprise me. Not that I Married a Witch is an unsexy film because, I mean, Veronica Lake spends a lot of time in her jammies, and also she the first time she shows up, she's naked. I mean, you don't see anything, of course, but there's that implication. I don't know if there's any such innuendos with Bell, Book, and Candle. But yeah, you're right. Bell, Book, and Candle is kind of the missing link there in the genealogy between between Bewitched and I Married a Witch. So yeah, Bewitched is going to – okay, so when Bewitched comes out in the 60s, more people are remembering Bell, Book, and Candle perhaps than I Married a Witch. So, okay, and then Bewitched. I mean, what do you have to say about it? It's Bewitched, and apparently that's what the makers of Bewitched, the 2005 film, felt. which is, you know what? People are just so familiar with Bewitched. Oh. When we do our Bewitched movie, let's not even... We cut out there?
We did, but we're good. Let's just keep going.
Okay. So... by the time they get around to making a Bewitched movie, they say, you know what? People are so familiar with Bewitched. Let's catch people by surprise. Let's not even just do like a 90-minute version of the pilot to Bewitched. Let's make it a movie about the making of a Bewitched relaunch. But it's a real witch. And she's going to star in a new pilot based on Bewitched, and this is a universe where everybody has seen Bewitched, and I haven't seen a film. I may not have ever seen a film which so completely exemplifies everything that's wrong with Hollywood. Like right now.
What's really funny, of course, about this is that concept of. Making a TV show, making a TV relaunch, because 2005 was late for these things. This, of course, started in the, I want to say in the early 90s, right?
Oh, you yeah. Know,
Flintstones was probably the commercialist peak. Yeah, Brady Bunch. You know, Car 54, Where Are You, of course, did not do that well. But there had not been... that much success lately with these things. And so they seem to think they had this great idea for how you could do Bewitched and make it fresh. But you've got Nora Ephron and her sister doing it. So it's this incredibly lame approach to what I assume they think is an avant-garde sort of...
I kept asking, like, who's this movie for? I mean, because if it's for people who, I mean, obviously it's for people who have no taste and who will just go see anything. Let's go get that out of the way. But I mean, if it was for fans of Bewitched, they would be annoyed that this was trying to be a tongue-in-cheek, like, postmodern version that didn't really have anything to do with the original Bewitched. And if it's for people who haven't heard of Bewitched, which, you know, in 2005, you have to assume, like, is a lot of people at this point, then they're not going to get all these, like, clumsy references to the original show. And some of them are even kind of involved. I mean, there's a parody of the opening animated titles where the joke is that all the focus is on Darren. Instead of, you know, and they don't even show Samantha's face. And it's like, you have to have at least seen the animated opening titles for the show to get that joke. But you also probably need to have, like, seen them recently. And, I mean, by 2005, I don't think Nick at Nite was even running Bewitched anymore. I think they had moved on to, like, The Cosby Show by that point. So I don't know who this movie is for.
Well, let's not forget that there's also the, and you were looking forward to this because you were going to, you know, be able to talk about Will Ferrell, and I'm watching it and I'm like, this is going to be the worst movie to talk about Will Ferrell about because, okay, so he's making fun of himself. It's Will Ferrell mocking himself in this movie, only the solution to this that Nora Ephron comes up with is to recast him as a lame leading man. Like, it's a romantic comedy leading man. It's he ends up having less edge than Billy Crystal in 1998 in City Slickers 2. He could not have less edge. And it's just, you're watching it and it's pain. There's, I mean, it's really boring and it's really long. I would say there's 40 minutes.
I know. It's
multiple
it's
dates with him and Nicole Kidman. Nicole Kidman, who can't even keep her accent. She's been working in Hollywood since 1990. 15 years. She can't even hide her Australian accent. I think some of the problem is that Nora Ephron, at times I'm like, did she direct her to try and sound like Marilyn Monroe? Because it's not working. It is the... And then you realize that there are all sorts of problems with it because Michael Caine's only in it for a little bit. Then he disappears for a while. Jason Schwartzman's in it for a while. And then he disappears for a while. Shirley MacLaine, I think it's third billing. And she is in it for, 6 minutes? And she has a huge subplot that goes nowhere. And it's like it got cut out because this movie is a disaster. It is a complete an utter disaster, and it was a disaster when they were making it, you can tell, and it's just awful.
Yeah. You mentioned how Nora Ephron might have been directing her to act like Marilyn Monroe. Okay, Nora Ephron, woman writer, director, essayist, author. She looks like a horse, just going off of her IMDb page. Nicole Kidman's version of Samantha, who is called what, Ingrid in this version?
Isabella. Yeah.
Okay. Is like retarded. She is like the dumbest bimbo of a ostensible leading female part that I can remember. And was that, I mean, Nora Ephron doesn't have any excuse for that. She co-wrote this with her sister. It was like, what was their idea for the witch character, for Nicole Kidman's character? I mean, okay, first of all, it's impossibly convoluted because Nicole Kidman is a real witch who doesn't seemingly, it's like they don't give her any backstory whatsoever except that she's a witch. So from that, it's just implied that she doesn't know anything about the way us normal humans live our lives. But there's all this inconsistency. Like, she doesn't – like when Will Ferrell approaches her and he's like, hey, you're a nobody, but you'd be perfect to play the new Samantha on the new Bewitched with me. It's like she doesn't seem to know what the movies are or acting is, but she's seen Bewitched, the show.
Well, and the other thing is, I think that my favorite sign of there being a big problem with the script and everything and the production is there's a big mention of her mother, and that's one of the reasons she's becoming a regular person is because something happened with her mother. Her mother does not appear in the movie. Michael Caine does, and Michael Caine is her father, and it's like, you're waiting for something, it's just atrocious, and I'm sitting there like, oh shit, wasn't Nicole Kidman in The Stepford Wives too? Isn't that another famous piece of shit remake?
There's a lot of talented people in this, you know.
I thought Shirley MacLaine was hilarious. I mean,
besides the people you mentioned, I mean, there's also these Daily Show people who show up. Stephen Colbert is in it. Mo Rocca shows up for 2 seconds, and then like in the last 20 minutes, you get this bizarre extended cameo from Steve Carell where he's doing a Paul Lynde impression, pretending to be Paul Lynde's character from the show, and Will Ferrell is having a dream that he He's being given advice by him. And you know what? That kind of, now that I think about it, reeks of like Nora Ephron being like, this movie's a piece of shit. I need to get somebody funny in here. Let's write a scene for Steve Carell. What'll he do? Oh, let's just have Will Ferrell have a dream about him where he's Paul Lynn's character from Bewitched.
It's well, the whole ending has, it doesn't make any sense because they have to protract the him and Nicole Kidman getting back together because it's become this lame romantic comedy. And you wonder, I mean, Will Ferrell at this point in his career was still making movies for other people. I don't know. I mean, I'm not like an expert on this, but I'm pretty sure he has not made a lot of movies that he did not produce following this one. And I wonder if it has something to do with the fact that it must have been a miserable shooting experience. I think his hair changes throughout. When he falls in love, he stops doing his highlights. And you're supposed to believe that Will Ferrell is a basically Tom Cruise. You're supposed to believe he's Tom Cruise, and they should have made a crack about that because it would have been really inappropriate. And that's what this movie needed, was some inappropriateness. I mean, it has no, I think they must have been trying to get a, well, it's, is it even PG-13 or is it PG?
Looks like it's PG-13.
So, yeah. I mean, they must have been trying to appeal to, like, first day mall crowd or something, because
who's the movie for? It's, I think this movie is for, like, dull-witted women who are old enough to have grown up with Bewitched in a very casual way and need a movie to take their daughter to.
Okay, yeah, something like that. But then you're also supposedly appealing to the hipster audience because you've got Jason Schwartzman in it. And there's this implication that Jason Schwartzman, his backstory is that he's going to be like a agents or demons or something. And it's a throwaway line, but I'm like, did they actually cut this?
I wasn't expecting that. I mean, I wasn't expecting them to go all the way with that. But Jason Schwartzman as the agent kind of points to the fact that, like, so much of this movie has nothing to do with Bewitched or with the, you know, farcical romantic comedy situation of a mortal falling in love with a non-mortal, be they a witch or a genie or a nymph or whatever the hell, you know, William Shakespeare came up with however many hundred years ago the first time. It's just like, it's just all this like really lame, toothless Hollywood satire about, you know, casting and agents and rewrites and people's careers and showing up on Inside the Actor's Studio. And I hate people. I really hate someone like Nora Ephron, who grew up her whole life. It's like her parents were screenwriters. She grew up in the Ivy Leagues, and she had a real easy access into Hollywood. I mean, she was married to Carl Bernstein, for God's sake. You know, Hollywood, quote unquote, Hollywood royalty ain't what it used to be. I mean, it used to be that if you grew up with movie star parents, you could have become like Janet Leigh or somebody. But, you know, now it's like you're Nora Ephron and you just make, it's like you don't have any like life experience to draw on. So this is what, you know, this is what you and your sister come up with to pad out your movie.
Well, no, I mean, here's the thing. I was trying to remember what I know. Of course, Nora Ephron is famous for doing, oh God,
Sleepless in
Seattle. She wrote When Harry Met Sally, but she also,
and Sleepless in Seattle.
In Seattle. So no. She did Silkwood. Have you seen Silkwood? Silkwood's really good.
No.
Silkwood's really freaking good. Yeah. Huh. It's scary. It's disturbing. It's upsetting. You know, it's about you want to talk about a woman in a movie, it's like, it's alienation that you don't really ever see in, for a female role, it's the guy being alienated, but instead it's the woman, and it's very different because it has to do with how it affects, you know, it's supposed to be based on a true story, but it has a really good setup for showing how alienation would affect someone. Really great freaking movie. I mean, it's one of those, it was like the first
Meryl Streep
movie I ever saw. No, let me, and then she did Heartburn, which I guess I've never seen. That's
wait,
actually, yeah.
No, I thought you did, and that's what I was going to ask you about. I thought I saw a review of Heartburn on Stop Button.
No, I've never seen it. I've never seen it. I've always been interested because, of course, it is the story of her being married to Carl Bernstein.
Fictionalized.
Yeah, but I've never seen that. And then, of course, we hit When Harry Met Sally. And, of course, that's a big, momentous hit, right? And then she did Cookie, but she did Cookie the same year, and I'll bet she wrote it before When Harry Met Sally. And it's Orion, so who knows how long it was sitting on the shelf. Then she did My Blue Heaven. I bet she actually did that before When Harry Met Sally. I bet she wrote that a while ago. Then she starts her, like, she does This Is My Life with Julie Kavner. I still remember the previews. I'm like, oh, my God, it's Marge. but then, of course, Sleepless in Seattle. And then it just start, the problems start. Mixed Nuts. That is an unwatchable piece of crap.
also co-written with her sister, I see.
I think her sister co-wrote everything atrocious. What is her...
You've Got Mail with Meg Ryan.
Which I've never seen, but I think that's considered at least watchable. But I know that Hanging Up is supposed to just be ungodly.
Got Michael with John Travolta.
Michael, yeah, there's another one. Yeah, nobody wants to see
Michael. And this is a movie where you can kind of see a direct lineage to Bewitched because it came out 4 years afterwards. Julie and Julia. You remember this movie?
I didn't see it. Yeah, I mean,
okay, but it's the same like unnecessary convoluted school of screenwriting where it's like, you know, doing a movie about Julia Child would be plenty for one movie, but they decided that it should also be about a woman in modern day who is blogging about Julia Child.
Well,
and blogging about her recipe. And this woman has nothing to do with Julia Child except the fact – I mean, it's just like why take it to that extra dimension? Why make it unnecessarily complicated?
Well, because you need the obnoxiousness of Amy Adams. She's so lovable, man. She's just lovable.
But is it just like Nora Ephron having like really low expectations for her audience's intelligence that like a movie with the story of Bewitched isn't enough to keep people interesting? We have to have it like
think about popular female directors. What's her name? Laverne, executive produced Bewitched. She produced.
Ooh.
What is her name again? I can't remember her name. God. Marshall? Penny Marshall. Penny Marshall. Big freaking deal when she was really popular. That did not last very long. I don't know. Did she end up doing a TV adaptation? I think she probably did, right? Like, let me see. Yeah, when she did Big and Awakenings, and then she ended up doing Renaissance Man, that didn't help. Preacher's Wife was a hit, but I mean, come on, really? I'd love to hear what Spike Lee has to say about that.
I can only name one other female director, Penelope Spheeris.
Okay, but she doesn't really count because she never crossed over, right? What was her post?
The biggest movie
Wayne's
she
World.
Ever did was Wayne's World, in
right.
a mainstream sense.
And then there's what's her face? Oh, I cannot remember her name, but all of her movies are very nice. And the Jack Nicholson, I like. I mean, I actually like a lot of what she does as a director. What Women Want. What's her face? Ugh, God, she makes. it's complicated. She always does one at Christmas. What is her name? Nancy Myers. Okay, so it's there aren't any female directors that have any sort of they don't last.
Yeah.
Even Jodie Foster, you know, critical darling Jodie Foster is now, you know, she was, people really liked Little Man. It was a big deal when she was directing movies and she did Little Man Tate. And then she, you know, did Home for the Holidays, which is freaking amazing. And nobody saw it. It was like a PolyGram release. So like six people saw it. And then she, of course, spent like 5 years trying to make a movie with Russell Crowe playing a carny. And that never happened. And then she made The Beaver, which came out in 10 theaters. And she had to send out a letter saying, Mel Gibson might be a psychopath, but my movie's good. yeah, so I mean, it's like nobody, not even the most famous female, you know, movie, one of the most famous female movie stars of the last 30 years can have any sort of sustained career. Some of it is because I would say the successes are flukes. I mean, I appreciate the humor in, I appreciate, like, say, what's the famous scene in Sleepless in Seattle with the Dirty Dozen? How guys get sad about the Dirty Dozen while women get sad about Love Story or whatever. I mean, I don't think it's that funny, but I get that it's funny in a really bland sort of sort of way. And I mean, Bewitched doesn't have a single good joke. I mean, it's got Shirley MacLaine upstaging as Shirley MacLaine. She's basically playing, she's doing a caricature of herself. And yeah. And she's funny. And I mean, when Bewitched started and they had the whole scene in the Bed Bath & Beyond with Michael Caine and Nicole Kidman bickering about whether or not she could give up being a witch, I was like, holy shit, they just watched I Married a Witch and they're like applying that.
I know, to... because it's like Bewitched, the TV show, didn't even have Samantha's dad. Like it was the aunt, right?
Well, her mom and Dora, and I think they wanted to not either. Didn't want to cast her opposite somebody else or something. But then if you look at who Penny Marshall wanted for this movie back when they first optioned it in the 90s during the whole bubble of
TV remakes,
it's freaking crazy. It's unbelievable that – who was it? They were going to get – Meryl Streep to play Samantha, Barry Humphries in Dame Edna as Dora, Robin Williams as Uncle Arthur, and
wow. All-star cast.
Shelley Winters is the neighbor who isn't even really in this. I mean, like, I haven't watched Bewitched in 20 years.
It's so sad how that would have been so much of a better movie.
Here's the thing. Jerry Seinfeld and Billy Crystal alternating as Darren as like a joke about it being the Darrens alternating. I mean, so this Bewitched sounds like when you'd hear in the late 90s that Quentin Tarantino was attached to like 60 million things and he was going to do crazy shit with them all and he never did.
Right, like he was going to do a James Bond movie or a Friday the 13th movie.
And he never did a single freaking thing because the fact that, go listen to our Quentin Tarantino episode about that. But, I mean, it sounded that crazy. And in some ways, this sounds that crazy. It's like, it's Wes Craven's new nightmare, only with Bewitched.
Yeah, it really is.
It's incompetent, and it's sad, and it's depressing. And
I know. It's like, you have to wonder, like, was everybody involved just contractually obligated to do this and couldn't get out of it? You don't get the sense that a single person was willingly participating in this movie. There's just such an overall lack of enthusiasm. Even Will Ferrell, and all right, I'm obliged to bash Will Ferrell just a little bit because I was teasing that last episode. My beef with Will Ferrell is that his whole shtick is like that he is exasperated and trying to be taken seriously even though he's a buffoon, and that's how he plays every single one of his characters. It's never any different, and it's certainly not any different in Bewitched. His whole character in Bewitched is that he wants this Bewitched, you know, the new Bewitched TV show to relaunch his career, but nobody's taking that seriously, so his voice gets all high-pitched and whiny as usual. But look, I'll give him this. He was, you know, in an incomprehensibly shitty movie as this, he certainly was the least painful aspect. I mean, whatever. At least he had a little bit of freedom to be a little silly. Even Steve Carell doing Paul Lynde it was kind of too little, too late. But I mean, Will Ferrell. I'll say it. Will Ferrell was the best thing in the movie.
Wow. Now, did you notice that? Also, just to crap on Nora Ephron a little bit more, did you notice she, like, did a bunch of musical shots?
She liked her crane shots. I did notice that.
I was just like, why are you directing it like this? It is not, you know, she treated the romance as seriously as, you know, something incredible, like a pretentious mirror. It was like freaking... It's the one with the desert that won all the Academy Awards and nobody likes it anymore. They made fun of it on Seinfeld. English Patient. She thought her romance was as profound as the English Patient.
Well, you know what's fucked up is that like the movie doesn't even take the romance between Will Ferrell and Nicole Kidman seriously until the movie is half over.
Right, because it's stupid. It's an idiotic plot development.
Right, and it's literally happening because, you know, Nicole Kidman puts a spell on Will Ferrell, again, stealing from I Married a Witch. And then, like, right about at the halfway point, she realizes that she's like, oh, it's not real love if I put a spell on him. So she rewinds time, and then Will Ferrell is in love with her for real? I mean...
Well, because, you know, by going into the future, she's realized how she can... I mean, it's just...
But the point is, like, suddenly the movie takes the romance seriously where it hadn't before, and then it's just, like, torturous. Because then it's like you are... Because then it's like you are watching stupid Sleep in Seattle or When Harry Met Sally, but with Nicole Kidman and Will Ferrell, who happen to be acting on a sitcom.
And then, did you notice at the end?
And she's a real witch, yeah.
Did you notice at the end how they like tried to introduce this idea that they couldn't keep their identities straight because Bewitched was so powerful in their lives that it confused them about their own identities? I mean, like... It's you know, Romeo and Juliet. Baz Luhrmann isn't going to take, you know, The Great Gatsby this seriously. It's so dumb.
Yeah, especially in the final shots where they suggest that Will Ferrell and Nicole Kidman are moving in with each other, and there's prying next door neighbors, and now they're going to be living Bewitched in real life. And also, and you know what really sucks about this movie too is how like the last, I mean, by about what point would you say in I Married a Witch does Friedrich March find out that she's actually a witch? Like maybe a little past the halfway point? Right about the point, I think so, because that's about the point where her dad magically shows up and is going to frame Friedrich March for murder. And then he realizes that, okay, her dad's actually a witch and so she's a witch too. She's telling the truth. But in Bewitched with Nicole Kidman, this is like an hour and 40-minute movie, and Will Ferrell doesn't find out she's actually a witch until the last 20 minutes, and then all they do in those last 20 minutes is have Steve Carell show up so that he can pilot Will Ferrell around in a flying car so they can catch up to Nicole Kidman.
And it's unclear why, and it's just so bad.
Yeah, it really is a failure on every level. And also bad for women, I will say. I think whatever work for feminist causes Nora Ephron has done in her career was completely undone by this film.
Didn't she do some like really serious stage plays about feminist writers or something?
Oh yeah.
They should have stripped her of, you know, any acclaim for this one.
She wrote critical essays about how like Wellesley College had produced, you know, generations of housewives and, you know, really serious feminist tracts like that. And then she has like Nicole Kidman play the most retarded woman in movie history.
No, The Neighbor. The Neighbor was more retarded.
No, The Neighbor, yeah. And they're just instant friends because they're so dumb together. And there's literally a joke about how women – there's literally a joke about how women just like to jump up and down giggling about nothing. Like – That that joke was written by two sisters. How progressive.
Oh.
I don't just mean like members of the sisterhood. I mean, you know, Nora Ephron and her sister. There's only one more thing I want to add to Bewitched, and I think we're done. But, you know, just looking at like the time that this movie came out, I think it's kind of coincidentally awful that the same year that Bewitched came out, you had that movie Rumor Has It with Jennifer Aniston. In which Jennifer Aniston finds out that The Graduate was actually based on a true story and that her mom is the real Mrs. Robinson. Like, what the fuck was going on that
year?
Well,
that at least...
And what the fuck... No. What was going on with Shirley MacLaine? Shirley MacLaine was in Stupid Rumor Has It also.
Well, at least in... Well, it's because Shirley MacLaine is the only actress of that age who works.
Okay, fair enough.
At least... The original impetus for Rumor Has It, which I have not seen, it was, what was it? It was Steven Soderbergh's screenwriter, like...
Oh, it's a gentleman named Ted Griffin.
Ted Griffin. He got fired, like, because they were like, dude, you're insane. You can't, you know, this is terrible. What you're doing is terrible. And so then Rob Reiner came in and did it. And I assume that, like, the terrible one was at least interesting as opposed to a Rob Reiner movie, which hasn't been interesting since, I don't know, before he met Nora Ephron. There's that joke, the wonderful joke that I love so much about Paul Haggis, that before Roger Ebert saw Crash and decided it was the single greatest, most profound look at race in America ever, somebody on the internet, and I hope it isn't Harry Knowles because he is a dipshit. He made some comment along the lines of, so the Crash, does that mean they're going to take away Paul Haggis's Oscar that he won for, Million Dollar Baby? It's like, Bewitched. Should someone have stripped Nora Ephron of her...
Did she
win an Academy Award for When Harry Met Sally? I feel like she did. I could just be making that up, though.
I don't know. But it's, you know...
It's one of the worst movies we've watched for the podcast because there's nothing interesting or funny or... Worse than The Net.
Less entertaining, certainly. Yeah. All right, but, you know, I feel like we learned a lot watching it and thinking about Nora Ephron.
I figured I was going to spend most of this talking about how much Nicole Kidman sucks, but we talked about Nora Ephron too much.
Yeah, Nicole Kidman looks all right, and who cares if she can't keep her accent straight. I don't know, but we're let's make this promise. Let's never do Stepford Wives original and remake.
No.
I don't think I could take it. And I'm surprised that the Stepford Wives movie didn't take place in a world where everybody has seen the Stepford Wives, but, you know.
Frank
Anyways.
Oz is too classy, that's why.
Yeah. All right. So, speaking of bimbos, our next episode is a intergalactic sex kitten double feature. I haven't seen the ostensibly good movie yet, and you say it's not that good. I don't think. Have you seen our bad movie?
No, I never have.
Okay, but I am betting that the bad movie is going to be even worse. So at least maybe it'll be, you know, kind of a bad worse kind of double feature. But we are going to watch Barbarella, starring the great VC Gunner Jane Fonda, and the follow up bad movie will be the very blatant Barbarella knockoff Galaxina. And both these movies are about some beautiful babe in space firing off lasers and hopping from planet to planet and trying on shoes, I guess. I don't know. All kinds of stuff. and
trying on
yeah,
shoes. What a sexist
I'm
joke.
Quite looking
Did
forward
Nora
to
Efron write that? I mean,
I'm surprised her and her sister. Yeah, I got that from them. Okay, but yeah, Galaxina. And Barbarella and Galaxina, it'll be out of this world, right, Andrew?
Yes, it will. It'll be out of this world with wings. You do know there are wings in Barbarella, right? There are wings that look cheaper than Flash Gordon.
I do.
Okay. So
I was
know.
About to say I'm expecting some very Flash Gordon-esque photography effects, and I also know that the name Duran Duran came from Barbarella, so got that to look forward to.
Yeah.
Okay, so everybody join us for that. Visit AlanSmithyPodcast.com, and we will see you next time. So for an Alan Smithy podcast, this has been Matt.
And this has been Andrew.
And thanks for listening.
Night, ladies. Ladies, good night. It's time to say goodbye. Let me tell you now. Good night, ladies. Ladies, good night. It's time to say